Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Delphine Auvilleur, France's third ever female rabbi. She's editorial director of the Jewish quarterly magazine Revue de Pensée Juive. As well as this, she leads a Jewish congregation in Paris and co-leads the liberal Jewish movement of France. She's authored a number of books on Judaism. The latest is Antisemitism Revisited, How the Rabbis Made Sense of Hatred. Delphine, welcome to the programme. It's really lovely to speak to you because also, of course, rarity value. You're one of only four female rabbis in France.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Yes, we are indeed very few female rabbis in France. It's linked to probably historical heritage and many other reasons, but it's still perceived as something very different or rare or abnormal even in France.
I mean, France has, I think, the largest European Jewish community. Is that mostly Orthodox, which would prohibit female rabbis?
I think to understand this, you need to take into consideration French Jewish history. About two centuries ago, Napoleon decided to create a central body of representation for French Jewry, and he created a structure called Le Consistoire, and it's supposed to represent the Jewish community in France. It's led by a chief rabbi, and this organization, centralized organization, created a recipe of kind of lack of pluralism in France, and slowly evolved to be an Orthodox body, an Orthodox institution, and it prevented somehow progressive voices of Judaism to develop or to be recognized. So in a way, the way French Jewry is organized, very different from the Anglo-Saxon world, I think, created a difference. And it took time for progressive sensibilities of Judaism to develop.
Mm. And where is the liberal Jewish movement now? I mean, I think there's been a lot of growth, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's now one of the, I think, big movements now here in Paris. I'm lucky to be one of the leaders of a large congregation called Judaïsme en Mouvement. And our congregations, our synagogues in Paris, we have three spots in Paris, and together we have about 1,500 families who join our movement. And definitely, I think our services are probably one of the most crowded on a regular basis in on Shabbat evenings here in Paris. Obviously, the crisis we're going through now, it changes everything in terms of joining congregations on Fridays. But indeed, the movement grew strongly in recent years. I lead, as you said before, a magazine of Jewish thought called Tnua, and we developed in Tnua a kind of Bet Midrash, a house of study, and we meet every month now for to study together. To give you an example, now that we switched to a screen mode, like a virtual mode of learning, we have thousands of people joining us to study every month. Last week, we had an event, Fruté Noir, where 2,000 people were connected together simultaneously to study with us. So indeed, I think that there is a strong pattern of like a will to study and to join a probably more progressive mode of Jewish study here in France.
Mm. We know, of course, that France is a staunchly secular country, and religion is expressly banned from public life. So how difficult is it then to practice your religion?
Well, I think it has no really impact on the way we practice our religion. People are free to practice the religion they want here in France. But it's true that the French secular definition of what we call here laïcité, which is actually a kind of lost in translation. You know, laïcité is not what in the Anglo-Saxon world we call secularism. Laïcité is a promise that the French Republic makes to its citizen that no religion will take the lead in public sphere, in public ground. Laïcité is a kind of promise that you will feel no pressure of your religion or your belonging in the public sphere. So actually, it has no impact, I could say, in the way I practice privately my religion. But it does have an impact in a very interesting manner. You know, you asked before how I can explain that progressive voices of Judaism are sometimes underheard or less outspoken than Orthodox ones. And I think it has something to do with French laïcité and French secularism in a way, in an interesting manner. You know, it seems to me that in France, because religion is really not that important in people's life, because it's a very secular or even atheist country, it tends to develop. I often meet people in my synagogue, or even people who go to church or to mosques, who tell me that, you know, they don't expect their religious leaders to fit their liberal values. They don't expect a rabbi or a priest to, you know, to preach their progressive values, because in a way they think that religion is not that important for them, that they expect their leaders, you know, to fit their values in civil life. I don't know if what I'm trying now to explain is that clear. It seems that, you know, in countries where religion plays a very important role on public ground, you expect more often religious leaders to fit your political views. And it's not the case in France.
So, I mean, I guess this is quite a difficult question, but how would you define a French Jew, and how does the religious aspect match up with other things like being a French citizen or being an accountant or whatever?
Well, again, I would go back to history. I think you can never understand a Jewish identity anywhere in the world if you don't take into consideration the historical context. France is a very, I would say, interesting country in terms of facing Jewish identity, because France has been the place of the most important, I would say, light and darkness for the Jews. You know, France is the place where the Jewish community gained first its emancipation, but it's also the place where Vichy and collaboration was made possible. It's the place where Léon Blum was the very first Jewish person to become, to be at the head of the state in the 1930s, but it's also, you know, the country where so many Jews were attacked in recent years. And in a way, it's difficult to understand the situation of French Jews if you don't take into consideration this weird equilibrium between the blessings and sometimes curses that France has brought forth for French Jews. So I think it impacts definitely this history, the way French Jewry has developed.
And been subject to anti-Semitism, obviously, which is the subject of your book. Now, you are the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors on both sides. And I wonder how much that epigenetic inheritance has affected you.
Well, it's a very good question. I don't know if I would be able myself, you know, to answer this question. My grandparents on my mother's side were indeed survivors from Auschwitz, and I grew up like many others of this third generation after the Shoah in a very profound silence. You know, my grandparents never spoke about their experience, but I had this consciousness from a very early age that a tragedy had stricken my family and we couldn't talk about it, but through silence, something passed through. You know, we know today, we know today that very often things are said through silence in families. And it seems to me that I had very early in my life this consciousness that I was the heir of this story. And today I'm aware of how much it has to do with my choice to become a rabbi, because in a way, in my rabbinic activity, I'm engaged constantly in a conversation with silence. This is the very core of what interpretation is. You know, you face a text and a tradition, and it requests from you to read in between the lines. And it seems to me that somehow It has something to do with my heritage and this, the heritage of the Shoah in my family. Mm. On the other side, on my father's side, my grandfather was a rabbi. He was ordained as a rabbi in France in the 30s, also before the war, and then decided to be something else. But his rabbinic, I think, stature had a huge impact on me, definitely. And I keep thinking of, yes, how much this... on both sides of my family, this heritage has something to do with the fact that I had to ask very early in my life questions about my Jewish identity, but also about how it was perceived by others. And I had to dive very early in my life in this question of hatred.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad that you've been able to break your personal silence. My cousins who live in France have never even publicly admitted that they have any Jewish heritage whatsoever because they're so frightened that history will repeat itself. Which brings us onto your book, Antisemitism Revisited. Now, you've taken a completely different view on this. You're focusing the debate around Jewish literature. Tell us more.
Yeah, when I started to write or inquire about this topic, I thought that, you know, so many books have been written about anti-Semitism through, you know, historical lens, sociological lens, or even psychoanalytical lens. But very few books have been written about the rabbinic view on anti-Semitism. Of course, it's an anachronism. You know, the rabbis don't speak about that word. It was invented in the 19th century. But they do speak a lot about their consciousness that hate of Israel, this is how they call it, the hate of Israel, of the people of Israel, has been present all along history. And from their point of view, will remain present. And they are trying not to find a recipe against anti-Semitism, but they're pretty aware that they recognize features in society that enable anti-Semitism to grow. And it was striking for me to see that interpreting the Bible, but also in the Talmud, it means like edited 2000 years ago, we have very interesting keys and features to explain what happens in a society or in a group and a family that enables that hate to grow. What is the name of the anti-Semitism? What does it describe? What kind of existential crisis in a society it reveals? And the rabbis invite us to pay attention to that and to be able to acknowledge that it keeps coming back. And indeed, what they have to say about conditions that enable anti-Semitism is very, very relevant for today, because we do live in a time when where those features are again so much present. To tell that, to say what they mean in a few words, they seem to be convinced, the rabbi and our sages, that each time a society or a group becomes obsessed with identity, with purity, and with authenticity, so anti-Semitism is around the corner. Because from their point of view, and I think that history has proven them right, from their point of view, for the anti-Semites, the Jew is always the noun or the name that prevents you from being truly yourself. You know, when a society is obsessed with being truly, authentically, or purely what it should be, faithful to its original history and nature, so very, very fast, the Jews become the name or the people or the group that seem to prevent them from being wholly themselves.
And in fact, you quote Sartre, you say, an inauthentic Jew is one whose Jewishness remains entangled in the image others have of him.
This is the big Sartrean theory of réflexion sur la question juive. It's the name of the book that Sartre wrote immediately after the war in 1946. And his whole theory is to say that you are a Jew only through the eye of the other, like actually the other makes you Jewish. And in my book, I try to show that it's both true and not true, that indeed we are impacted by the way we've been looked upon along history. And in a way, we did react to those accusations in the way we shaped even our identity. But at the same time, Judaism relies, and Jewish identity relies upon other things, which has nothing to do with the way, with the gaze of the other, but have a lot to do actually with the fact that we are, and it may seem paradoxical, we are totally unable to define what makes us Jewish. Jewish identity, authentically, is an inability to define it authentically. Mm. Like, we have no idea, and it's the subject of so many books and entire literature. We have no idea of what makes you Jewish. You know, are you Jewish because your parents are Jews, because your children are Jews, because you behave in a certain way or believe certain things? No one is able to finish to define this definition. And because there is no closed definition of what being a Jew means, it's an infinite possibility of being. And it goes against precisely the anti-Semitic obsession of defining what he is, what she is, and it's a kind of closed identity that Jewish identity by definition breaks.
Mm. Now, you were talking earlier about ancient texts and how the words anti-Semitism weren't used, but the word Israel was. And I think that that's a big problem for people these days, in that people conflate Israel with Jewishness, and you can be anti-Israel's political stance and foreign policy, but that doesn't make you necessarily anti-Semitic.
Yeah, absolutely. It was important for me in this book to go back to all the names we carry with us. The name Hebrew and the name Israel and the name Jew all have their own history in our text. And I think that, you know, as you can imagine, as a rabbi, I'm particularly interested in the history of words, in the way they can act in our lives as tools, but sometimes also as weapons. You know, we know that language and words have this capacity to build and to destroy. They can be tools or weapons of mass construction or mass destruction. And the rabbis are pretty aware of that. And they invite us to dive into the history of the word Hebrew and Jew and Israel. To take, for example, the last one, Israel. Israel is the name of Jacob in the Bible. It's a name that we gain through a fight. You probably remember this episode in the Bible. Jacob fights or struggles, wrestles against a being, a man or an angel. It's not really clear. And when he, you know, when light comes in the morning after that night of wrestle, Jacob limps. And he limbs, and at the same time, he gains a new name that we inherit, the name of Israel. And the rabbis define this identity of Israel as being a kind of limbing identity. It's an identity that prevents you from standing still. It's an identity of someone who forever will have to perceive itself as a kind of in-between identity. To confront it to the idea of naming a state, the state of Israel, that we so much, you know, relate to, is a state of settling. So how do we confront this biblical idea of a limping Israel with the idea of finally settling in a place? It's a very challenging thing to do. It's kind of a laboratory of Jewish thinking for today. And we perceive how much of an issue and sometimes an hatred issue it is for others.
Mm-hmm. So what impact do you hope this book will have, and on whom?
So the book was released in France at the beginning of year 2019, and it was a huge success here. It was a bestseller for quite a few months here in France. So I was very impressed, I have to say, moved to see that so many people, obviously non-Jews, looked in that book for maybe not answer, but at least ways to nurture their questioning. It was striking for me to see that people read that book in the subway, in the streets of Paris. And it's a book indeed full of rabbinic literature. It's a book of interpretation. It's filled with Talmud and Midrash and rabbinic legends. And for me, it's an attempt to show that the world of the rabbis and rabbinic thinking has a lot to contribute to the ongoing discussion, that we can create bridges between words of thinking. And I think this is definitely what we need today to think about this question of anti-Semitism, but more largely to think about any question today. How do we manage to create bridges between very different expertise, and we can strengthen our understanding when we are ready to explore someone else's mindset?
Absolutely. Delphine, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us.
Thank you.
That's Rabbi Delphine Auvilleur and her book Antisemitism Revisited, How the Rabbis Made Sense of Hatred, has just been published in English by Maclehose Press. It's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Charlie Filmer-Court and Christy Evans. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.